Dagny was 32 years old when she told James Taggart that she would resign. She had run the operating department for the past 3 years without title, credit, or authority. She was defeated by loathing for the hours, the days, the nights she had to waste circumventing the interference of Jim's friend, who bore the title of vice president in charge of operation. The man had no policy, and any decision he made was always hers, but he made it only after he had made every effort to make it impossible. What she delivered to her brother was an ultimatum. He gasped, "But Dagny, you're a woman. A woman is operating vice president? It's unheard of. The board won't consider it." "Then I'm through," she answered. She did not think of what she would do with the rest of her life. To face leaving Taggart Transcontinental was like waiting to have her legs amputated. She thought she would let it happen, then take up the load of whatever was left. She never understood why the board of directors voted unanimously to make her vice president in charge of operation. It was she who finally gave them their San Sebastian line. When she took over, the construction had been underway for 3 years. One-third of its track was laid. The cost to date was beyond the authorized total. She fired Jim's friends and found a contractor who completed the job in 1 year. The San Sebastian line was now in operation. No surge of trade had come across the border, nor any trains loaded with copper. A few carloads came clattering down the mountains from San Sebastian at long intervals. The mines, said Francisco d'Anconia, were still in the process of development. The drain on Taggart Transcontinental had not stopped. Now she sat at the desk in her office, as she had sat for many evenings, trying to work out the problems of what branches could save the system, and in how many years. The Rio Norte line, when rebuilt, would redeem the rest. As she looked at the sheets of figures announcing losses and more losses, she did not think of the long, senseless agony of the Mexican venture. She thought of a telephone call. "Hank, can you save us? Can you give us rail on the shortest notice and the longest credit possible?" A quiet, steady voice had answered, "Sure." The thought was a point of support. She leaned over the sheets of paper on her desk, finding it suddenly easier to concentrate. There was one thing, at least, that could be counted upon not to crumble when needed. James Taggart crossed the anteroom of Dagny's office, still holding the kind of confidence he had felt among his companions at the barroom half an hour ago. When he opened her door, the confidence vanished. He crossed the room to her desk like a child being dragged to punishment, storing the resentment for all his future years. He saw a head bent over sheets of paper, the light of the desk lamp glistening on strands of disheveled hair, a white shirt clinging to her shoulders, its loose folds suggesting the thinness of her body. "What is it, Jim?"
"What are you trying to pull on the San Sebastian line?"
She raised her head. "Pull? Why?"
"What sort of schedule are we running down there? And what kind of trains?"
She laughed. The sound was gay and a little weary. "You really ought to read the report sent to the president's office, Jim, once in a while."
"What do you mean?"
"We've been running that schedule and those trains on the San Sebastian for the last 3 months."
"One passenger train a day?"
"In the morning. And one freight train every other night."
"Good God! On an important branch like that?"
"The important branch can't pay even for those two trains."
"But the Mexican people expect real service from us."
"I'm sure they do."
"They need trains."
"For what?"
To help them develop local industries. How do you expect them to develop if we don't give them transportation?"
"I don't expect them to develop."
"That's just your personal opinion. I don't see what right you had to take it upon yourself to cut our schedules. Why, the copper traffic alone will pay for everything."
"When?" He looked at her. His face assumed the satisfaction of a person about to utter something that has the power to hurt.
"You don't doubt the success of those copper mines, do you, when it's Francisco d'Anconio who's running them?"
He stressed the name, watching her. She said, "He may be your friend, but..."
"My friend? I thought he was yours."
She said steadily, "Not for the last 10 years." "That's too bad, isn't it?
Still, he's one of the smartest operators on Earth. He's never failed in a venture. I mean a business venture. And he sunk millions of his own money into those mines. so we can rely on his judgment.
When will you realize that Francisco D'Antonio has turned into a worthless bum?
He chuckled. I always thought that that's what he was, as far as his personal character is concerned. But you didn't share my opinion. Yours was opposite. Oh, my, how opposite. Surely you remember our quarrels on the subject. Shall I quote some of the things you said about him? I can only surmise as to some of the things you did.
Do you wish to discuss Francisco D'Anconia? Is that what you came here for?
His face showed the anger of failure, because hers showed nothing.
You know damn well what I came here for, he snapped. I've heard some incredible things about our trains in Mexico.
What things?
What sort of rolling stock are you using down there?
The worst I could find.
You admit that?
I've stated it on paper in the reports I sent you.
Is it true that you're using wood-burning locomotives?
Eddie found them for me in somebody's abandoned roundhouse down in Louisiana. He couldn't even learn the name of the railroad.
And that's what you're running as Taggart trains?
Yes.
What in hell's the big idea? What's going on? I want to know what's going on.
She spoke evenly, looking straight at him. If you want to know, I have left nothing but junk on the San Sebastian line, and as little of that as possible. I've moved everything that could be moved, switch engines, shop tools, even typewriters and mirrors, out of Mexico.
Why in blazes?
So that the looters won't have too much to loot when they nationalize the line. He leaped to his feet.
You won't get away with that. This is one time you won't get away with it, to have the nerve to pull such a low, unspeakable, just because of some vicious rumors, when we have a contract for 200 years, and—
Jim, she said slowly, there's not a car, engine, or ton of coal that we can spare anywhere on the system.
I won't permit it. I absolutely won't permit such an outrageous policy toward a friendly people who need our help. Material greed isn't everything. After all, there are non-material considerations, even though you wouldn't understand them.
She pulled a pad forward and picked up a pencil. All right, Jim. How many trains do you wish me to run on the San Sebastian line?
Huh?
Which runs do you wish me to cut, and on which of our lines, in order to get the diesels and the steel coaches?
I don't want you to cut any runs.
Then where do I get the equipment for Mexico?
That's for you to figure out. It's your job.
I am not able to do it. You will have to decide.
That's your usual rotten trick, switching the responsibility to me.
I'm waiting for orders, Jim.
I'm not going to let you trap me like that.
She dropped the pencil. Then the San Sebastian schedule will remain as it is. Just wait till the board meeting next month. I'll demand a decision once and for all on how far the operating department is to be permitted to exceed its authority.
You're going to have to answer for this.
I'll answer for it. She was back at her work before the door had closed on James Taggart. When she finished, pushed the papers aside and glanced up, the sky was black beyond the window, and the city had become a glowing spread of lighted glass without masonry. She rose reluctantly. She resented the small defeat of being tired, but she knew that she was tonight. The outer office was dark and empty. Her staff had gone. Only Eddie Willers was still there at his desk in his glass-partitioned enclosure that looked like a cube of light in a corner of the large room. She waved to him on her way out. She did not take the elevator to the lobby of the building, but to the concourse of the Taggart Terminal. She liked to walk through it on her way home. She had always felt that the concourse looked like a temple. Glancing up at the distant ceiling, she saw dim vaults, supported by giant granite columns, and the tops of vast windows glazed by darkness. The vaulting held the solemn peace of a cathedral, spread in protection high above the rushing activity of men. Dominating the concourse, but ignored by the travelers as a habitual sight, stood a statue of Nathaniel Taggart, the founder of the railroad. Dagny was the only one who remained aware of it, and had never been able to take it for granted. To look at that statue whenever she crossed the concourse was the only form of prayer she knew. Nathaniel Taggart had been a penniless adventurer who had come from somewhere in New England and built a railroad across a continent in the days of the first steel rails. His railroad still stood. His battle to build it had dissolved into a legend because people preferred not to understand it or to believe it possible. He was a man who had never accepted the creed that others had the right to stop him. He set his goal and moved toward it, his way as straight as one of his rails. He never sought any loans, bonds, subsidies, land grants, or legislative favors from the government. He obtained money from the men who owned it, going from door to door, from the mahogany doors of bankers to the clapboard doors of lonely farmhouses. He never talked about the public good. He merely told people that they would make big profits on his railroad. He told them why he expected the profits, and he gave his reasons. He had good reasons. Through all the generations that followed, Taggart Transcontinental was one of the few railroads that never went bankrupt, and the only one whose controlling stock remained in the hands of the founder's descendants. In his lifetime, the name Nat Taggart was not famous, but notorious. It was repeated not in homage, but in resentful curiosity. And if anyone admired him, it was as one admires a successful bandit. Yet no penny of his wealth had been obtained by force or fraud. He was guilty of nothing, except that he earned his own fortune, and never forgot that it was his. Many stories were whispered about him. It was said that in the wilderness of the Middle West he murdered a state legislature who attempted to revoke a charter granted to him, to revoke it when his rail was laid halfway across the state. Some legislators had planned to make a fortune on Taggart stock by selling it short. Nat Taggart was indicted for the murder, but the charge could never be proved. He had no trouble with legislators from then on. It was said that Nat Taggart had staked his life on his railroad many times. But once he staked more than his life. Desperate for funds, with the construction of the line suspended, he threw down three flights of stairs, a distinguished gentleman who offered him a loan from the government. Then he pledged his wife as security for a loan from a millionaire who hated him and admired her beauty. He repaid the loan on time and did not have to surrender his pledge. The deal had been made with his wife's consent. She was a great beauty from the noblest family of a southern state, and she had been disinherited by her family because she eloped with Nat Taggart when he was only a ragged young adventurer. Dagny regretted at times that Nat Taggart was her ancestor. What she felt for him did not belong in the category of unchosen family affections. She did not want her feeling to be the thing one was supposed to owe an uncle or a grandfather. She was incapable of love for any object, not of her own choice, and she resented anyone's demand for it. But had it been possible to choose an ancestor, she would have chosen Nat Taggart, in voluntary homage and with all of her gratitude. Nat Taggart's statue is copied from an artist's sketch of him, the only record ever made of his appearance. He had lived far into old age, but one could never think of him except as he was on that sketch, as a young man. In her childhood, his statue had been Dagny's first concept of the exalted. When she was sent to church or to school and heard people using that word, she thought that she knew what they meant. She thought of the statue. The statue was of a young man with a tall, gaunt body and an angular face. He held his head as if he faced a challenge and found joy in his capacity to meet it. All that Dagny wanted of life was contained in the desire to hold her head as he did. Tonight she looked at the statue when she walked across the concourse. It was a moment's rest. It was as if a burden she could not name were lightened, and as if a faint current of air were touching her forehead. In a corner of the concourse by the main entrance there was a small newsstand. The owner, a quiet, courteous old man with an air of breeding, had stood behind his counter for 20 years. He had owned a cigarette factory once, but it had gone bankrupt, and he had resigned himself to the lonely obscurity of his little stand in the midst of an eternal whirlpool of strangers. He had no family or friends left alive. He had a hobby which was his only pleasure. He gathered cigarettes from all over the world for his private collection. He knew every brand made, or that had ever been made. Dagny liked to stop at his newsstand on her way out. He seemed to be part of the Taggart terminal, like an old watchdog too feeble to protect it, but reassuring by the loyalty of his presence. He liked to see her coming, because it amused him to think that he alone knew the importance of the young woman in a sports coat and a slanting hat, who came hurrying anonymously through the crowd. She stopped tonight, as usual, to buy a package of cigarettes. "How is the collection?" she asked him. "Any new specimens?" He smiled sadly, shaking his head. "No, Miss Taggart. There aren't any new brands made anywhere in the world. Even the old ones are going, one after another. There's only 5 or 6 kinds left selling now. There used to be dozens. People aren't making anything new anymore. They will. That's only temporary. He glanced at her and did not answer. Then he said, I like cigarettes, Miss Taggart. I like to think of fire held in a man's hand. Fire, a dangerous force, tamed at his fingertips. I often wonder about the hours when a man sits alone watching the smoke of a cigarette, thinking. I wonder what great thoughts have come from such hours. When a man thinks, there is a spot of fire alive in his mind, and it is proper that he should have the burning point of a cigarette as his one expression.
Do they ever think? She asked involuntarily and stopped. The question was her one personal torture, and she did not want to discuss it.
The old man looked as if he had noticed the sudden stop and understood it. But he did not start discussing it. He said instead, I don't like the thing that's happening to people, Miss Taggart.
What?
I don't know. But I've watched them here for 20 years, and I've seen the change. They used to rush through here, and it was wonderful to watch. It was the hurry of men who knew where they were going and were eager to get there. Now they're hurrying because they are afraid. It's not a purpose that drives them, it's fear. They're not going anywhere. They're escaping. And I don't think they know what it is that they want to escape. They don't look at one another. They jerk when brushed against. They smile too much, but it's an ugly kind of smiling. It's not joy, it's pleading. I don't know what it is that's happening to the world. He shrugged. Oh, well, who is John Galt?
He's just a meaningless phrase.
She was startled by the sharpness of her own voice, and she added in apology, I don't like that empty piece of slang. What does it mean? Where did it come from? Nobody knows, he answered slowly.
Why do people keep saying it?
Nobody seems able to explain just what it stands for, yet they all use it as if they knew the meaning. Why does it disturb you? He asked.
I don't like what they seem to mean when they say it.
I don't either, Miss Taggart. Eddie Willers ate his dinners in the employees' cafeteria of the Taggart Terminal. There was a restaurant in the building, patronized by Taggart executives, but he did not like it. The cafeteria seemed part of the railroad, and he felt more at home. The cafeteria lay underground. It was a large room with walls of white tile that glittered in the reflections of electric lights, and looked like silver brocade. It had a high ceiling, sparkling counters of glass and chromium, a sense of space and light. There was a railroad worker whom Eddie Willers met at times in the cafeteria. Eddie liked his face. They had been drawn into a chance conversation once, and then it became their habit to dine together whenever they happened to meet. Eddie had forgotten whether he had ever asked the worker's name or the nature of his job. He supposed that the job wasn't much, because the man's clothes were rough and grease-stained. The man was not a person to him, but only a silent presence with an enormous intensity of interest in the one thing which was the meaning of his own life, in Taggart Transcontinental. Tonight, coming down late, Eddie saw the worker at a table in a corner of the half-deserted room. Eddie smiled happily, waving to him, and carried his tray of food to the worker's table. In the privacy of their corner, Eddie felt at ease, relaxing after the long strain of the day. He could talk as he did not talk anywhere else, admitting things he would not confess to anyone, thinking aloud, looking into the attentive eyes of the worker across the table. The Rio Norte line is our last hope, said Eddie Willers, but it will save us. We'll have at least one branch in good condition where it's needed most, and that will help to save the rest. It's funny, isn't it, to speak about a last hope for Taggart Transcontinental? Do you take it seriously if somebody tells you that a meteor is going to destroy the Earth?
I don't either.
From ocean to ocean forever. That's what we heard all through our childhood, she and I. No, they didn't say forever, but that's what it meant. You know, I'm not any kind of a great man. I couldn't have built that railroad. If it goes, I won't be able to bring it back. I'll have to go with it. Don't pay any attention to me. I don't know why I should want to say things like that. Guess I'm just a little tired tonight. Yes, I worked late. She didn't ask me to stay, but there was a light under her door long after all the others had gone. Yeah, she's gone home now. Trouble? Oh, there's always trouble in the office, but she's not worried. She knows she can pull us through. Of course it's bad. We're having many more accidents than you hear about. We lost 2 diesels again last week. One just from old age. The other in a head-on collision. Yes, we have diesels on order at the United Locomotive Works, but we've waited for them for 2 years. I don't know whether we'll ever get them or not. God, do we need them. Motive power. You can't imagine how important that is. That's the heart of everything. What are you smiling at? Well, as I was saying, it's bad. But at least the Rio Norte line is set. The first shipment of rail will get to the site in a few weeks. In a year, we'll run the first train on the new track. Nothing's going to stop us this time. Sure, I know who's going to lay the rail. McNamara of Cleveland. He's the contractor who finished the San Sebastian line for us. There, at least, is one man who knows his job. So we're safe. We can count on him. There aren't many good contractors left. We're rushed as hell, but I like it. I've been coming to the office an hour earlier than usual, but she beats me to it. She's always there first. What? I don't know what she does at night. Nothing much, I guess. No, she never goes out with anyone. She sits at home mostly and listens to music. She plays records. What do you care which records? Richard Halley. She loves the music of Richard Halley. Outside the railroad, that's the only thing she loves. Chapter 4. The Immovable Movers. Motive power, thought Dagny, looking up at the Taggart building in the twilight, was its first need. Motive power, to keep that building standing. Movement, to keep it immovable. It did not rest on piles driven into granite. It rested on the engines that rolled across a continent. She felt a dim touch of anxiety. She was back from a trip to the plant of the United Locomotive Works in New Jersey, where she had gone to see the president of the company in person. She had learned nothing. Neither the reason for the delays nor any indication of the date when the diesel engines would be produced. The president of the company had talked to her for 2 hours, but none of his answers had connected to any of her questions. His manner had conveyed a peculiar note of condescending reproach whenever she attempted to make the conversation specific, as if she were giving proof of ill-breeding by breaking some unwritten code known to everyone else. On her way through the plant, she had seen an enormous piece of machinery left abandoned in a corner of the yard. It had been a precision machine tool once, long ago, of a kind that could not be bought anywhere now. It had not been worn out. It had been rotted by neglect, eaten by rust, and the black drippings of a dirty oil. She had turned her face away from it. A sight of that nature always blinded her for an instant by the burst of too violent an anger. She did not know why. She could not define her own feeling. She knew only that there was in her feeling a scream of protest against injustice, and that it was a response to something much beyond an old piece of machinery. The rest of her staff had gone when she entered the anteroom of her office, but Eddie Willers was still there waiting for her. She knew at once that something had happened by the way he looked and the way he followed her silently into her office. What's the matter, Eddie? McNamara quit. She looked at him blankly. What do you mean, quit? Left, retired, went out of business. McNamara, our contractor? Yes. But that's impossible. I know it. What happened? Why? Nobody knows. Taking her time deliberately, she unbuttoned her coat, sat down at her desk, started to pull off her gloves. Then she said, "Begin at the beginning, Eddie. Sit down." He spoke quietly, but he remained standing. "I talked to his chief engineer long distance. The chief engineer called from Cleveland to tell us. That's all he said. He knew nothing else." "What did he say?" "That McNamara has closed his business and gone." "Where?" "He doesn't know. Nobody knows." She noticed that she was holding with one hand 2 empty fingers of the glove of the other, the glove half removed and forgotten. She pulled it off and dropped it on the desk. Eddie said, "He's walked out on a pile of contracts that are worth a fortune. He had a waiting list of clients for the next 3 years." She said nothing. He added, his voice low, "I wouldn't be frightened if I could understand it. But a thing that can't have any possible reason."
She remained silent. He was the best contractor in the country. They looked at each other. What she wanted to say was, "Oh, God, Eddie." Instead, her voice even, she said, "Don't worry. We'll find another contractor for the Rio Norte line." It was late when she left her office. Outside on the sidewalk at the door of the building, she paused, looking at the streets. She felt suddenly empty of energy, of purpose, of desire, as if a motor had crackled and stopped. A faint glow streamed from behind the buildings into the sky, the reflection of thousands of unknown lights, the electric breath of the city. She wanted to rest. To rest, she thought, and to find enjoyment somewhere. Her work was all she had or wanted. But there were times, like tonight, when she felt that sudden, peculiar emptiness, which was not emptiness, but silence, not despair, but immobility, as if nothing within her were destroyed, but everything stood still. Then she felt the wish to find a moment's joy outside, the wish to be held as a passive spectator by some work or sight of greatness, not to make it, she thought, but to accept, not to begin, but to respond, not to create, but to admire. I need it to let me go on, she thought, because joy is one's fuel. She had always been, she closed her eyes with a faint smile of amusement and pain, the motive power of her own happiness. For once, she wanted to feel herself carried by the power of someone else's achievement. As men on a dark prairie like to see the lighted windows of a train going past, her achievement, the sight of power and purpose that gave them reassurance in the midst of empty miles and night. So she wanted to feel it for a moment, a brief greeting, a single glimpse, just to wave her arm and say, "Someone is going somewhere." She started walking slowly, her hands in the pockets of her coat, the shadow of her slanting hat brim across her face. The buildings around her rose to such heights that her glance could not find the sky. She thought, "It has taken so much to build this city. It should have so much to offer." Above the door of a shop, the black hole of a radio loudspeaker was hurling sounds at the streets. They were the sounds of a symphony concert being given somewhere in the city. They were a long screech without shape, as of cloth and flesh being torn at random. They scattered with no melody, no harmony, no rhythm to hold them. If music was emotion, and emotion came from thought, then this was the scream of chaos, of the irrational, of the helpless, of man's self-abdication. She walked on. She stopped at the window of a bookstore. The window displayed a pyramid of slabs in brownish-purple jackets inscribed, "The Vulture is Molting." "The novel of our century," said a placard. "The penetrating study of a businessman's greed. A fearless revelation of man's depravity." She walked past a movie theater. Its lights wiped out half a block, leaving only a huge photograph and some letters suspended in blazing midair. The photograph was of a smiling young woman. Looking at her face, one felt the weariness of having seen it for years, even while seeing it for the first time. The letters said, "In a momentous drama giving the answer to the great problem, should a woman tell?" She walked past the door of a nightclub. A couple came staggering out to a taxicab. The girl had blurred eyes, a perspiring face, an ermine cape, and a beautiful evening gown that had slipped off one shoulder like a slovenly housewife's bathrobe, revealing too much of her breast, not in a manner of daring, but in the manner of a drudge's indifference. Her escort steered her, gripping her naked arm. His face did not have the expression of a man anticipating a romantic adventure, but the sly look of a boy out to write obscenities on fences. What had she hoped to find, she thought, walking on. These were the things men lived by, the forms of their spirit, of their culture, of their enjoyment. She had seen nothing else anywhere, not for many years.